Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Meet the Farmers. We're back to normal with the podcast this month with a visit to a farm in North Suffolk. Fiona Proven is a tenant dairy farmer who runs the Calf at Foot micro dairy on the Somerleyton estate. I went to meet her for morning milking to hear the fascinating story of how she came to be running a small herd of Jerseys in East Anglia. I hope you enjoy it.
My father was a veterinary surgeon. He was single-handed and he needed all of us on board. There's just two of us, me and my sister, and mum, of course. It was a proper family business down in Hertfordshire. He specialised in cattle and I loved going out with him to the dairies and the suckler herds, doing TB testing. We always had to, you know, sort of stop cows going here, there and everywhere and do the paperwork for Dad with all the testing. And with the tricky calvings, we always insisted Dad took us with him, even in the middle of the night. But he'd always say, "No, Fiona, you know, you stay here." But often we'd end up pulling on the ropes with the other farmers. And I used to love that, pulling on the calving ropes and helping the cow. Because obviously I only ever saw difficult calvings when I was a young girl. My next door neighbours, we were on a large estate, very much like this one, and there were tenant farmers and they used a mobile milking bale, which was pulled along the back of an old David Brown tractor. And often the milking bale was situated in the meadows next to our house. I fell in love with the farm and the family. There were three girls, Stella, Katie and Diana, and they became our best friends. And we spent all our holidays basically on the dairy farm, feeding the calves and helping with the milking, moving, herding the cows, which was my favourite thing. It still is. It's all of our favourite thing is herding the cows, stopping the traffic, crossing the cows over the roads. There was a Frisian herd, very small, probably about 40 cows. They moved away. They lost their tenancy. That was a really sad time for us. And then when they moved off, it was probably then in the 70s, I'm 53 now, and I saw the four water meadows next to us then become one huge, big arable field. They bulldozed all the and grubbed out all the hedgerows and the spinneys, and then the outlook from our kitchen window was just one big prairie field of probably about 100 acres. And then next thing you'd see the planes, they actually flew the planes down spraying the crops. It was very depressing times, and we saw that all over the whole estate, the pastures being ploughed up. I didn't know the meaning of that, but I knew it felt wrong and bad, and it was very ugly.
So that was quite an important time in your life in terms of setting your way of thinking.
Yeah, that was really when big farming was taken over and the small tenants and the pigmen were going out. A lot of Dad's clients, they were his best friends, they were losing their farms. And I started to campaign for animal rights, and I joined Compassion and World Farming and donating money and lots of, you know, like there was I4, Greenpeace, and I was really horrified at seeing it from all, but I was getting sort of stuff from all over the world, and Dad would see these. He was a very hard Scotsman, and he was really part of the change as well. He more or less sort of supported the harshness of farming. And when I was on these farms, I'd see the farmers beating the cows with sticks, and I used to wonder why Dad didn't stop them when I saw, you know, lots of cruelty going on and the cows standing in a load of slurry while their calves were in these dark sheds. Then I started to realise, as obviously I was getting lots of stuff through the post about the bobby calves and the veal trade, and then I started campaigning against it, and then that's when it all sort of started to click together. I was desperate to go and work on one of our other neighbouring dairy farms. I was a very naughty girl at school, hated it, just thought, I didn't know why I was there. I couldn't fit in the box, because all I wanted to do was just be outside with the birds and the cows and on the riverbank, just watching and hearing nature and being in amongst it. And I was very depressed. I became depressed. George Finlay wanted me to go and be his stockman. He said, you know, women have the best stockman's eye because they've got the nurturing receptors in their brains. And Dad and Mum were, no, you know, you're broadening your horizons, Fiona. Sent me to secretarial college. Big mistake. Wow. And then I remember the careers teacher saying, what do you want to do? I thought, I can't say, I just love nature. You know, that just sounds so stupid. And I just said, well, she said, what do you like doing? I was like, cooking. Next, I was in a yop scheme, and it was completely, I went to work in the local brasserie. That's where I got my best training. And that was harsh. It was sort of Gordon Ramsay's got nothing on David Ricketts. <I don't know. laughs> In literally 17-hour days down in the cold chiller cellar, boning and skinning fish and you know, chips, and it was brilliant, brasserie. But and then I went to Cordon Bleu Cookery School in London, and I felt so guilty that they'd paid so much money for me to do this. I actually got a qualification, so I've got the blue ribbon. Went from kitchen to kitchen, left home, went down and worked, did seasonal work in Dorset in a gorgeous hotel, really little rickety old Hansel and Gretel place in Dorset called, it was on the Isle of Purbeck at Studland Bay. I stayed in the old cowl shed, and I had loads of boyfriends and boys up in Hertfordshire, and they used to come and stay with me, and I'd bring out, we'd all go and sit on, we'd go skinny dipping, and it was just me and sort of like eight blokes, and yeah, we got to all sorts of really naughty things. Like we took on the big hotel down the road and I remember like beer bottles being lobbed over and big, yeah, anyway, it's really naughty, we were naughty. So that was good, that was fun. Went from kitchen to kitchen, really. Chef Stew, really did hate it, and someone said you're like a caged lion.
When did you decide? So with then, the catering side, enough's enough.
Yeah.
This is.
Well,
for
my
me.
Parents just kept pushing me back. I can't do it. I'm depressed. I can't do it. So much depression. So insecure. Quite a wild girl. I just thought, how can I get out of this? My parents are pushing me into this. And I just thought, well, the way to do it, I always wanted to be a housewife. I really wanted to be a farmer's wife and be part of the farm. I ended up marrying my best friend because I just thought, I've just got to have kids, then I don't have to work. It sounds terrible, but that's what I did. And it was, you know, it didn't work. I had three kids very close together. I had my first one and thought, I'm going to get sent out to work if I don't have another one. Got pregnant again, and I had three kids under three, and I remember thinking, now I don't have to go out and work. That was a nightmare. Lots of postnatal depression. Trying to steer my husband towards, let's have a farm. It wasn't fair on him.
What did he do?
He was a loss adjuster, so it just couldn't have been more different. But we were sort of close family friends. As I said, his sister was my best friend. He gave in the end to buying a house with some land, like a small holding. When the kids were very young, my father bought me a house cow. That was the best thing he ever did. A little Jersey called Flicker, bought it from a close farming friend. And that's when I started playing with the milk. We had ponies and chickens and pigs. And then we moved up to Suffolk because obviously the land was cheap in Suffolk. He could still commute. He was working from home. And then my head was turned. It wasn't enough. I wanted to sell. I didn't want to be playing at it. I didn't want to be a hobby farm. It just meant nothing. I just felt empty, still suffering with depression. I wasn't proving to the world, still campaigning for animal rights. But it was, what I wanted to do was show you could make a living out of farming correctly, you know. And it was cows that was missing. We moved up to Suffolk. My head was turned because I was feeling still trapped. I left my husband. Had some terrible times, really, really terrible times for years, and a terrible divorce, and I absolutely broke my husband, to tell the truth. And then I met somebody else. I had amazing friends that just kept putting me up after broken relationships, and there was an old barn like this, but and I used to live in it, but it was a bit, you know, had fires in it and stuff. Amazing friends just kept me on my feet after breakups, and I'd go back there, and I just had such incredible friends all through. And then met someone else. He'd bought a farm, 60 acres, for about 250 grand. But we had buffalo, and he had a herd of red poll. We wanted the Suffolk Trinity, you know, the Suffolk sheep. But we also had black Welsh sheep, which were brilliant. So worked with him, and a bit of a nightmare. But it was still, at least I was keeping farming, and I was sort of doing other work on dairy farms. On the farm with the farmer I was with for 3 years, we had everything. We had geese, we had chickens, we had ducks, we had sheep, we had cattle. And the cattle were in sheds in the winter. And I remember, and we were feeding them all this rubbish stuff from a local merchant. Absolute rubbish in it. You know, there was mouldy whey, palm oil, lumps of palm oil. Everything was in it, everything. And I still didn't know that cows, I knew grass feeding was proper. I still didn't know that cows really shouldn't eat grain. Didn't know that. And I remember when he was fattening the bullocks inside, thinking, there's all that grass out there. Why are we giving them all this grain? And it was revolting, and the tank would get revolting. They were inside, they should have the sun on their backs. I'm thinking, and I used to come out the caravan and grab loads and loads of grass, and they'd wait for me to come out my caravan. And in the end, I left because of the didn't want to have babies. I had a huge breakdown. I was really very ill, and then moved away into my friend's barn. Got a little. There was divorce money, not much, but the thing was, and other friends were amazing. And I ended up with another friend who she's got a lovely little waffle coffee van, and she said, "Come on, let's get you a van, a street food van." And I got a Citroen H van. Okay, so this is where it really begins. You know me, had to be organic. Everything had to be locally sourced, organic, and I did burritos and fajitas and wraps, and they would be really. And I just used to work all night putting the stuff together in a tiny little kitchen, no bigger than this area. And I put a gazebo up outside in the back little courtyard area with big gas burners and all this. I'd be up all night cooking.
But you're enjoying what you're doing?
No. And
no. I'm waiting for this part. I'm waiting.
It was great. I think the thing is, when you work all through the night and then that adrenaline getting into those shows, and then you drive to throw in that bloody Citroen H van, you know, you're driving on the wrong side of the road, you're going to the other side of Suffolk for a big festival, you get there, okay, and then you're packing it up, and I'm a person that has to take everything. It's a definite, I carry a lot of baggage in here, and I do, and anyway, so it was mad, but it was fantastic, and it looked successful. It looked great, and, you know, obviously didn't make money, but we made quite a name. Now, I used to buy in milk from the local farmer, £1 a litre. It wasn't raw milk, and I did milkshakes. And we literally did organic strawberry milkshakes, just maple syrup. We did the chocolate with organic green and black, you know, and it was no additives, no nothing else, and they were beautiful. Those, as beautiful as my other things were, and, you know, it's great. It was really cool. It was really cool. It was funny because also, because you'd been up all night, maybe two nights cooking, you get then, you might get that you don't get a queue, and literally you've got all these pans and pans and pots of food. What the hell do I do with them? You know, to keep freezing them down and going back to the next one with them. But I would sell out of milkshakes by 11 o'clock. And I thought, I didn't know people like milkshakes. You'd get to sort of lunchtime, you'd think, oh, you know, I'm here. And then because of the lack of sleep, you'd get this, like, that feeling, that sort of, like, over... And I just burst into tears. It was obviously just lack of sleep and being overwhelmed and how this is so wonderful what I'm doing. But it was still missing. Sally and Edward, again, more amazing friends who I met through my ex. They have Red Poles, biggest Red Pole herd in Suffolk. They had 200 Red Poles. Anyway, so they gave me a few cull cows on the local marsh in the summer, and then I started to buy in a couple of Jersey cows. And I was thinking, I'm going out catering, I'm not doing my milking. And then, like, this milkshake thing, and I had a little a pony trailer at the back, and I used to milk in that. So I used to, you know, walk the cow in that, and that was great. I remember once stepping outside of my Citroen H van and thinking, milkshake, and I just thought, I can do it. I can have a tiny herd of cows, because I don't want masses, I don't want loads of concrete and slurry, and they can keep their calves. And it's going to be a micro dairy because I can get premium out of the milkshakes. And didn't necessarily have to be raw, and it didn't necessarily have to be grass-fed. And I thought, it's going to be a micro dairy. Now, the word calf-foot dairy still wasn't there at that term. And, oh, my God, I've got it. And I literally, it's like the whole world, you know, it's like that light bulb. When they say that light, and I thought, oh, my God, OK, there's two light bulb moments in this. I can do it. And I was, like, skipping along, you know, really... So, sold the van, started to buy in a few more little Jersey cows, practicing, realised couldn't do it with just this marsh here because I had to be off in the winter, and then I had another little meadow, can't do it with just two cows, this isn't going to work, and the house is too small. Found another house that had was bigger, a bit more rent, asked Mum to help me with the rent with that one, and then all the kids, my kids could come back and forwards, and that had, it was nearer Sally and Edward with the Red Poles, and... I had about 4 acres there, and they had old milk cattle sheds, cow sheds were milking the old. And I gradually, with another friend from my old neighbour, I'm just picking up these friends that just want to help, and he helped me smash out the concrete, get all the rubbish out, and put the drainage in. Really rough, not properly, nothing proper. I got someone from Defra to come along, and he was like, no, you can't do it. Friends were saying, it's got to be raw milk. And I said, I don't know about that. I don't know, has it got to be raw? Then Food Standards Agency came along. They took over from Defra, from certifying. They took over the raw milk standardised or registering. And I thought, right, that's it. Food Standards Agency, Milk Police, don't stand a chance. I'm not going to get registered to do this. Anyway, someone called Ray Ead came along. He was the inspector, and he was just a proper bloke. He used to give me roll me pre-inspection fags and post it, and after post-inspection fags. And I'd always be so stressed when he came along. He just said, I love what you're doing. I love it. He said, this is how it should be. And he said, we can do it. You can do it. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And I said, what about a milk cooling churn? And I couldn't, you know, they're like hen's teeth. You couldn't get it. And he said, and then he said, well, there's nothing here to say that you have to cool your milk within a certain time. Because I thought that's what's going to stop me. Because it was all, everything was domestic and everything was like literally no money. I got past, couldn't believe it. At that time, what I was doing to try and to keep in with selling food and farming and actually getting something out of the soil, out of the land, to actually be producing and selling something, having something come back, I was doing something called Suffolk Picnic Pasty. And obviously, it was local Maple Farms organic flour, their organic eggs. And I used veal at the time because I was finding it very hard to separate the calves from the cows. The calf at Foot Dairy hadn't come up yet. This is where it comes up. This is the second light bulb. And I was just mincing most of the cheaper cuts, selling the veal. And I did pasties. And of course, I'd be saying, this is all going towards my dairy. So I kept that. And I'm going to have this dairy where the cows keep their calves and da-da-da. And also the grass feeding. So it was going to be cows kept the calves, most important thing. Calf at Foot, which I hadn't named it yet then, raw. And then I think the grass feeding came last because then there was this, when I was saying, I want to set up a micro dairy, and I was ringing all these people like Helen Browning down in Wiltshire with her pigs, John Turner, Graham Harvey, Julian Rose, and all those people. And they were saying, oh, well, yeah, Julian Rose did do. He said, I did something like, I had a dairy with 40 Guernsey cows and kept the calves on. And he said, yeah, go for it and all this. And then I got Helen Browning, and they were lovely. They all had time for me. She said, read The Carbon Fields by Graham Harvey. I read it, and I realised how important pasture is. And then I went grass feeding, right, stop all the grain and all that rubbish. And then I got in touch with the Pasture Fed Livestock Association, talking to them. That's probably, I don't know, 2009 or something as well, 2010. And they were worrying about using dairy cows and grass. You're going to be a pioneer on this. We don't do dairy. You're the first one. We'll watch you, see how we go. Yes, certainly be part of us. We can register you as for your beef and your veal, and we'll test it on you. You'll be our sort of sample case, and the pioneer, you'll be the guinea pig. So that's where the grass feeding came from, Graham Harvey's Carbon Fields. Okay, so I was at the farmer's market in Southwold, and this customer was saying to me, right, she was saying, well, they keep the calves, and it's something Vasha, Votterall Mother's Side, by, and I went, that was the second light bulb, I went, the Calf at Foot Dairy. I said, it's Calf at Foot. And I said, thank you. Thank you so much.
So okay. If you could explain how Calf at Foot works.
Okay, so a cow has a calf. A cow has to have a calf to produce milk. A lot of people don't know that. Now, really, it's a suckler herd, but we're registered to milk them and sell their milk. The most important thing is that every cow is different, like we are as mums, different to the other mum in the next bed in the hospital. And we have our separate problems, and we have our... Some of us are really good at breastfeeding, some can't breastfeed. Cows generally can nurse their own, but there are problems with that sometimes. So that sort of thing we keep an eye on, but we let nature take its course. Calf just stays with mum completely at her side.
How much milk are you taking?
We average 60 litres a day. We can go 90 litres, we can go all the way. 40, we're scared. We get worried when we're on 40, we don't like it. But it's rare to go down to that now because we're still building, we're still learning, it's still obviously pioneering what we're doing. But we've got some cows that will literally only give a few litres, and they're often the fat cows. But that milk is normally very nutritious and incredibly creamy. If sales are low, we only milk the cows who don't have calves on them. So we can do it to suit us. If someone's ill, and we've got a cow with a 2-3-month-old calf on her, she doesn't need to be brought in if we're low. Now, when milk sales are high, this is how we manipulate it, then the calves have already been practiced going in the stable area with their own calf yard, with tiny ones, with bigger ones, and they all buddy up. And they even queue at the gate. And then they queue up, and then they go in there into their stable area and overnight. And then mum's obviously got enough milk. That's when sales are high. And then we'll milk her, but we'll leave one quarter for that cow so it's got the whole milk. That's if it's quite young, that's if it's 6 weeks. But by the time it's, say, 4 or 5 months, the heifers start getting a little bit fat, so we separate them more for their sake at night time. We take all of mum's milk, and then they just have to strip out that last bit. Then we get to about 8, 9 months, and we think, we've got to get that calf off. We separate more and more. Sometimes the calf will just wean themselves off, and that is brilliant. At about 9 months, we think about getting the cow back in calf. So she's not calving every single year. So it's less risk to her, less strain and stress.
Tell me a bit about the rest of the team.
Basically, anyone that wants to come and help can help, and I really did need help. Caitlin, how did you hear about this place?
Alison.
Oh, yeah, how did she hear about it? Caitlin's awful, isn't she? Don't know, you see? What sort of answer is that? Absolutely hopeless. She hates all this. Anyway, I think I had people at the last place just turn up and say, you know, I like what you're doing. I'd like to help you. Oh, brilliant. And then they get fed up because they're basically working sort of 14, 16 hours a day every day. And I don't let them go home. I just completely take advantage. And I start sitting on my backside on Facebook.
There's always someone else coming on.
Yeah. And they've, you know, I've had some amazing people that never touched a cow and they end up doing the whole milking and everything. And it's brilliant. And I just think even if they end up hating it and can't wait to get away, what an amazing thing that they've done. And then if ever I've had a conventional milker come, says, yeah, I've done it. Oh, this is just like a holiday. Oh, yeah. Oh, you don't want to be using all that spraying that water. You'll feel, this is all. And then they come, you don't need to tell me. You're over the top with your hygiene. I do 300 cows twice a day and I do it in half an hour, blah, blah, blah. And I've been doing it for 30 years. Next thing, he milks the cows and you're thinking, shit, look at the hands, the shit all over his hands and on the clusters. And she's just kicked her udder and she's got shit and he's putting that back on. We failed the milk tests. Amazing. Anyone that's done it before, we don't like. You get them in from the towns, they're not set in their ways. The ones that just love, they just think they love cows. They don't know cows, but they think they love them. They couldn't imagine taking the calves off. You know, they just sort of think they don't know any other dairy, but they have gone into other dairies and done that because it's important they see. And they just think it's crazy, you know, what they do in the other dairies.
Let's talk about that. Because the dairy industry...
Yeah.
I mean, there was an article published, I think it was in The Guardian, earlier in the year called Dairy is Scary. I don't know
Scary Dairy.
Whether you saw it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that was all part of the vegan...
Yeah.
The vegan anti-dairy push.
Yeah.
Obviously, what you're doing here is completely outside the convention.
Yeah.
And I'm just really interested in your take on public perception of dairy at the moment.
Well, in general, the general public, they are now being informed. They are getting the information because of social media and because of the vegans, which is actually good for us. We have people maybe on Facebook saying that, you know, it's okay. You can go to the Calf at Foot Dairy and what they do is okay. Now then, I can't even put the V word on Facebook, even if I put a quote up from a vegan. And I know where they come from because as you can tell, I come from a vegan perspective. It comes from not wanting to hurt animals or exploit them. Because of what they heard about scary dairy and humane milk is a myth, then they obviously start Googling and they find us. And they find that actually humane milk no longer is a myth. It's not a myth anymore. It's actually a real thing. There's such a thing. And then they'll post on my page, had your milk, it's amazing. And I can actually have milk and not feel guilty about it. Then the vegans find that we do beef. And then I just say, my animals don't know pain, they don't know fear. They're not stressed at the end. I take them to the abattoir myself. What's happened is that I've made drinking milk acceptable and they don't like it. It's like I'm taking their control away and people are hearing about it. And I've had one say to me, you've taken one of ours, because this vegan posted on my thing saying, I'm not vegan anymore because I found you. I don't have to be vegan. And then I get... Absolutely, I'm a pervert, I'm a rapist, and I'm a murderer and a paedophile with the last one.
It's just the language. It's very frustrating, and it has got
very
toxic.
No point fighting. One of the things I tell the vegans is, I don't know how I'm going to die. Like, you don't know how you're going to die, because they say, do you call your animals know you? You know them, and is that they say it's even worse, the fact that I've got this relationship with my cows, and then I go and shoot it. And then there's something, so you're being disloyal. You betrayed the animal. And I say, yeah, I have to live with that. I have to live with the betrayal that animal does not know I betrayed it. It doesn't know about betrayal. Yes, they're sentient beings, but they don't know about bloody betrayal. We are overbrained. That's where the spanner's in the work. So we're overbrained, we're overconscious, we're overthinking it.
As a tenant farmer,
yes.
So you're farming without subsidy, what are your biggest challenges now and how do you think your challenges are going to change in the next few years?
My challenge is to actually make a living. I've got to pay off my debts and then I think I can make a living. My challenge is to farm regenerative, to graze holistic, to properly manage the grazing. I think also the challenge is that a lot of people are copying us, which is what I've always wanted. And eventually, the word will get around that this is actually the way to go. This is what people want. This is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do.
And what about your hopes for the future in an ideal world? Where would Carfoot Foot Dairy here be going?
What we need to do is get a cow that's better suited to this poor pasture here. And that's crossing it with a red pole. We've got three quarter Jersey, quarter red pole coming through. And I think that might be the ideal cow for this, because basically it's still Jersey cow with a little bit of red pole in, and then it'll be better suited to the land. It just needs to make a family a living, and that's all. I want to train people. We've trained lots of people to it. Basically, you know, it's taking people out of towns who just have this desire to farm. So what I want to do is for it really to be a business that's in profit in that it's making a living, for someone to have a happy living, not to be a slave. If Caitlin took this on, the caveat would for her is you pass this on to someone else that will keep it as Carfoot Foot, and preferably with holistic management for the land and nurturing the land, learning about the soil and the land. It's not so important. It's all got to be sort of something. It's all got to be something, Ben. It's the only word I can think of, and that's something.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing your story, and yeah, I wish you absolutely all the best for the future. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.